This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 21st of May, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 32nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week, because someone had to do it, we're taking in the sun, sea, sand and mojitos and the oil on canvas at the 11th Havana Biennale.
We are a small island with a lot of culture and thirsty to know about new art, new music, books. The people here is incredible.
We'll also be examining the unique mind of a one-off stand-up comedian. Mike Bobilia joins the gang to tell us about his new show, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend.
In high school, I had my first girlfriend, and their only problem was that she told me that I couldn't tell anyone that she was my girlfriend.
And we attend the wildest book club in town at the Literary Death Match in LA.
Come over here, young lady. I'm gonna wrap this scarf around your head. What I need from you guys is to cheer wildly while this lovely young lady tries to pin a mustache on Hemingway. If you can come forward, are you ready?
Plus, we'll hear what went down when Barcelona's Sonar Music Festival hit São Paulo, and we'll talk 1970s fashion photography with Peter York and Jim Lee. That's right here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. But first, a song. Giles Peterson presents Havana Cultura. Is Giles Peterson's new record. I brought this back from Havana, and this is the second track. This is Agita featuring El Micha y Ostalgia. Thank you, Giles. That's how to start the show. That was Giles Peterson's Havana Cultura Band performing Agita featuring El Micha y Ostalgia. And now I'm off to Havana to look at some paintings. Ya está. The Havana Biennale is in its 11th year, although in reality it takes place every time Cuba can stump up the cash to stage it. But like any Biennale, it's the time when a city hitches up its skirts and shows you a bit of leg, and the international art crowd pop the string on their moleskins to write all about it. This year, the Biennial's focus was on a few places. The Grand Theatre, as once was, in the Parque Central, was full of ambitious installations afforded space by the scale of the place. Swallows nested in the eaves and swooped on the roofs of booths full of video installations and monumental contemporary sculptures. At the Pabellón Cuba, a beautiful, huge concrete roof kept the 34-degree sun off the art. Shh, listen. This, mostly, was wonderful stuff. A wind chime of 1,000 stainless steel spoons, witty videos in dark booths, bubbling cauldrons and airport metal detectors with attitude. La Cabaña Fortaleza, those well-refurbed battlements across the water, gave an elegant demilitarised home to a number of pavilions housing young artists. Alex Del Rio, from Havana, made golden skeletal arms attached to worn-in baseball gloves in a striking collection of 30, and called it National Sport. Alex, I wondered, it's called National Sport, we're standing in front of it, it's baseball gloves, it's maybe 30 baseball gloves that look ancient, attached to kind of bronzed limbs, and they're on pedestals. It's quite a striking work. Can you tell us what National Sport is about?
National Sport is baseball, as the piece suggests. It's the expressive resource I found to talk about a preconceived idea. He wanted to talk about waiting and the fact of spending years and years trying to see if something falls from the sky. Almost that's why he's interested in the past, like representing this pass of time and this baseball.
Channeling the hope of the lone outfielder might be a way of describing how an artist feels in Cuba, or maybe not. Another contemporary reading, in fresh neon, was provided by Lorena Gutierrez Cajal, another young Cuban artist fed up with riffing on history, looking to the future.
I'm a little bit tired that here in Cuba, because we are a poor country, we are using materials like, you know, recycling and that. And it, that's not that kind of art. We can make a lot of things. And we are evolutionary. The young artists are like making maybe some evolution in Cuban art. So I'm one of the artists that wants to make a change.
Too right. Taking a walk around the block in Havana is a history lesson in itself. Another off-biennial show, and the best, was A Smell That Comes Through My Windows by Havana Cultura, put together by Flora Fairbairn, a British curator who, luckily for us, gave us the down low on what happens to art in this vibrantly creative city.
This show is a culmination of a long project which I've been working on for 3 years with Havana Club, essentially to support local Cuban artists and provide a platform for them, both in Cuba and internationally further down the line.
And is it a sort of, what's it like working in Havana? Is it like an easy place for a curator to work? I mean, are you, apart from the practical aspects of some of the stuff, is there a general understanding and eagerness for a project like this?
Yes, it's, I wouldn't call it an easy place to work, but it's definitely, you're definitely, artists are particularly keen for foreign curators to be involved with their work. And it's very easy to work with them all because they're all so open and great and enthusiastic. Artists in Cuba have a lot less access to foreign art and a lot less, very little access to the internet. The internet is very, very expensive to use. So a lot of what they pick up comes from their teachers in the art schools. And if they have a particularly brilliant, inspiring teacher, then that shows in the work of the next generation of artists who've come through that channel. And a lot of the work you see in Cuba is political and based on being on an island that it's not easy to get off, or that if you do leave, it's difficult to come back. So there's a lot of that. It's very passionate. A lot of art in Cuba is performance-based. And a big issue in Cuba is very little resources, no public funding, and very little access to materials.
Adislaine Reyes-Pino had a lovely idea. Paper plates done as if they were priceless family china, centred on a monogram of old Cuba's families of quality. We all end up being thrown away, see? Or recycled, maybe. Adislaine also told us about the generational difference between the artists of the 60s and the 80s and the present-day young Cubans, here talking about themselves rather than the revolution.
Well, we're standing in front of a wall of plates that looks very, very traditional, but I don't think it is very traditional. Maybe you can tell me a bit about it.
She believes that it looks a traditional work, but it's true, it's contemporary work, because she used a very contemporary material, a dispensable material. The dishes are painted in dispensable dishes.
Is the political a common theme for artists in Cuba, do you think?
She is an artist, but beside of that, she is a professor of the elementary art school, very important academy in Havana, and she has opportunity to exchange with the students about the many issues. And yes, you have a reason, or your question have a good deal, because artists in Cuba always are thinking about political issues, but she considered that for this generation, the younger generation, the concern is politic, but it's more about themselves.
Very selfish people,
it's
artists.
Politic in relation with personal life. Before other generation, maybe the 19th generation of artists use the political issues with more topic, with more force in the sense of the like generational things, But now she thinks, and me too, like a creator, that this generation, the younger generation, use the political issues, but in relation with themselves life.
I wondered how you'd buy this stuff. What's the commercial element? How does a gallery scene, that ever-interesting confluence of art and cash, exist in a communist country? Luis Minat Perez is the director of the Galleria Habana, a mighty fine contemporary gallery with a block-long queue of international collectors champing at the bit for Cuban art. He explained how the market works.
Now, Habana Gallery is a company itself. We have two businesses. We have the gallery with contemporary art, and we have the auction house with the auction Habana house, which is more than 10 years. So we have two, let's say, business in one company. It's a public company with 35% of taxes in profits quarterly, so we pay every 3 months. And we have a system of paying everything we do, even production of our works, or the art fairs, or catalogs, etc. So it's, we take our risk as a gallery, but what we love is to have the relation we have with the artists we represent.
But, of course, it's a passion thing.
I'm happy because the relation I could make with really important artists from the beginning, we still are very close. For example, Los Carpinteros, they have a gallery in New York. Sean Kelly, they have a gallery, Fortes Vilas in Brazil. But we have the same prices, and I sell as the New York gallery. I'm proud to say that. They bring me, just bring me now 5 new pieces because they know we are, you know, trying to do the same job they do even in New York, in Havana. Some people come and say that, oh, this is supposed to be less expensive. You are wrong. It's one market, it's global market. It's when an artist is already established as an even young artist like Los Carpinteros, you need to keep that.
It seems in Havana that everyone has a lot to say, and many want to commit that to canvas or hammer a piece of stone into shape to say their piece. Luis might say it best.
We are a small island with a lot of culture and thirsty to know about new art, new music, books. The people here is incredible.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're back with the great American comedian after this.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of 3 bookshops in 3 cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region, and we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. After all that rum, you've got to laugh. Fortunately, Mike Babilia came in to make us do just that. A young veteran of the Sharkpool North American stand-up circuit, performing on Letterman at the age of 24, Mike brought his show, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, to London's Soho Theatre last week.
I just come off a very difficult breakup with my college sweetheart where we thought we were going to get married, and then we weren't. And then when we weren't, I was so heartbroken, I just kind of swore off the idea of marriage or even living with someone entirely. I just decided, as a rule, I'm not going to get married until I'm sure that nothing else good can happen in my life, you know? And that logically made sense. I never looked at my parents' marriage or anyone who'd been married more than 30 years and thought, I got to get me some of that. My friend Andy had solidarity with me about this, and we knew we were right. So not only did we decide we weren't going to get married, we actually tried to stop other people we knew from getting married. We stopped or put on hold probably 3 to 5 marriages. You know, we were pretty good. You know, We weren't the best in the world. I'm not saying we were better than people in Europe, but we were solid, you know. So like, I'll give you an example. If we sensed one of our friends was about to get engaged, we'd pull him aside and give him a long, hard stare. And we'd say, "Are you sure this is what you want to do?" And then we go cold to give him the sense of what it would feel like when we weren't friends anymore.
Mike, thanks for coming on to the show.
Oh, thank you.
My girlfriend's boyfriend, I've written this down and I've kind of thought about it a few times and tried to work it out. It's like an equation that you need to solve.
I know.
This is the name of your show that you're touring at the Soho Theatre in London right now.
Yeah.
Can you explain the title?
Well, it's got kind of a double or triple entendre. It's a romantic comedy about kind of love and pain and breakups and all of the torture that we go through in pursuit of love. And my girlfriend's boyfriend, I mean, people have to see it in the show, but one of the examples is that in high school, I had my first girlfriend, and their only problem was that she told me that I couldn't tell anyone that she was my girlfriend.
That's flattering, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, and she said she had another boyfriend at home, and they were in the process of breaking up, but it was a bad time because his parents were sick, and so I was trying to be understanding of that. And then, you know, so we went along with this for a few months until she invited me to meet her parents. And I was like, okay, this is the vindication I need. I'm going to be affirmed as the main boyfriend.
It's a solid goal guarantee. It's a stamp for you.
Exactly, there. Yeah. And I really, truly thought that. So I was like, okay, this is how it happens. This is where success stories are made from. And so I drive my mom's station wagon to Amanda's parents' house. And I walk in, and there's Amanda, and there's her parents. And it's going very well. And a few hours go by, and this other guy comes over to the house, and his name is Scott. I'm assuming he's like a family friend or a relative.
He sounds like a jock or something with a name like that.
Yeah, he was a wrestler. He was a wrestler. Okay. He was very good.
Did you
good.
Know that by his boots tied up to the knee?
Yeah, he was in a costume.
A mankini.
Yeah, no, he was in. You guys don't. Is wrestling not a serious sport here?
Yeah,
oh, okay. Because, yeah, no, it's. I know there's obviously the absurd wrestling. But then there's also real wrestling. No, he was a good athlete.
Muscular.
Yeah, he was like an attractive version of me. And and so I'm hanging out. I'm slowly realizing that I'm hanging out with my girlfriend's boyfriend. That's the title. But it actually got stranger because at one point he invited us to go hang out at his house. And I met his parents. And it's indescribable meeting your girlfriend's boyfriend's parents for the first time because, you know, part of you is angry and then part of you still wants to make a good impression. Well, you're like, well, maybe if this goes well, she'll see that I'm good with adults in general.
And this is similar to the show. There's a discursive side to the show. It is explaining about the idea of love and marriage and the loops and hurdles that you have to swirl through and jump over in order to kind of be accepted in an unacceptable world. Or maybe if you're an unacceptable person in an acceptable world, I don't know what. But it's got almost a novelistic thing. It's like a Greek myth, your stand-up show. It's a big, long, lovely thing that sort of comes back to the beginning, doesn't it? It's an odyssey.
We're going to use that quote. It's like a Greek myth. We're going to use that on the poster.
Put that on
the
poster.
Soho Theater. Yeah.
Put that on the poster and see how many people don't turn up. But you know what I mean? It does. It's a lot of stand-up shows are full of you know, machine gun punchlines, mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. This is a beautifully crafted thing.
Oh,
it's a silk tapestry, isn't it? Rather than you know, just a collection of gags.
Well, that's certainly the goal. I mean, thanks for saying that, but the British comedian that people compare me to so far a lot is Daniel Kitson, who I admire a great deal. I think he's incredible.
Yeah.
And he came the other night. It was just really nice.
What happens when you see people in the audience? Is it easy to keep your focus when you see people you know in the audience?
Yeah, I don't mind it. I don't like it. I don't
like it.
I don't enjoy
you're
it.
Being judged.
But,
you feel you're being judged.
But I've got, yeah, because I liked performing for strangers. So comedy is a little bit like stripping in that sense.
Yeah.
But just to bring it back to the title of the show, though, so my girlfriend's boyfriend, you know, there's that, and then there's a double entendre with the person who I dated as an adult, and I ended up marrying. I hope that's not a spoiler. It is in a way, but it's not really. You know, I tell a lot of stories about, like, my first kiss and my first girlfriend and all these awful experiences. I find that those experiences really do inform my adult life.
I guess they do. And in the show, you explain in minute detail, beautifully, novelistically, about your first kiss and about the dance and about the when's the right time to do the lunge and the sort of music. This presumably is stuff that has made a big imprint. I mean, it's part of the show, but it must be. I wonder how much of it's part of life. Are we allowed to ask that? Are we allowed to know how much is real and how much is...
Well, I always say this about my shows, because I have two shows that are autobiographical. One is called Sleepwalk With Me, and that was my first one-man show, and this one's called My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. And I always say this when people ask. I say, well, the parts that you would think are not true are true. And the parts that are sort of minutiae are probably fudged. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, there's timeline issues and chronologies that they're a little more convenient than they are in life.
I wanted to know how you work, whether you write stuff down, whether you sort of riff on it. A lot of stand-up shows, when they're in their infancies, are sort of, there's trial nights, aren't there? Where you do stuff, like stripping in front of strangers.
Oh, yeah.
And you're trying to choose your music that you're stripping to. You're kind of wondering which bikini to have on underneath, which underwear to take off first. And when a stand-up show's in its infancy, I mean, how much does it change from the show that you're touring right now to how it started? Is it a collection of jokes that you string together? Or
No. It's very different. Like, I have stories that I go on stage with in, I don't know, the equivalent of, like, I don't know, the Comedy Store here. Uh-huh. I've never been there, but I know what it is. Yeah, I go to U.S. comedy clubs. I try to go off the radar. I try to go in quiet places where there's 70 people or something. Uh-huh. And I put stories on stage that I think are interesting. I mean, what I try to do is I try to tell the stories that I'm completely uncomfortable telling. To me, that's where the jokes come from, is if you can just go into something like that story about my girlfriend's boyfriend that I was just telling you. I didn't tell that story for years. I mean, that happened when I was 17 years old. I don't think I even told anybody till I was like 27 years old, because I was so embarrassed.
And at what point do you realize that it's damn funny?
I think it's like, I think most of the stories in my shows are things that eventually, you know, I'm having a few drinks with friends and we're all throwing stories back and forth. Uh-huh. And I say, well, listen to this. And then when they're if they're laughing, I'm going, well, maybe I should say this on stage.
That was comedian Mike Birbiglia talking to me earlier, and his show, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, is on at London Soho Theatre until the 26th of May. Still to come in part two, we'll be attending the world's wildest book club. We'll hear from iconic fashion photographer Jim Lee about his latest collaboration with Peter York. And we'll find out what happened when Sonar Music Festival hit São Paulo. Time now for a bit more Cuban music. This is La Quiminaria from Juan Formel y Los Vanyan.
Atención para todos los bailadores del mundo. La maquinaria ya salió.
All right, don't spill your mojito on the studio rug. That was La Maquinaria by Juan Formel y Los Van Van. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Band. Dozing off at a reading at a bookstore, squirming through a badly curated literary night. Being at one too many draining author events is what pushed writer Todd Zuniga to come up with an antidote. Literary deathmatch. Part game show, part cocktail party, and part poetry slam, Zuniga's literary mutation aims to get audiences whipped into a bookish frenzy. Since his 2006 debut in New York, the nomadic competition has sparked literary nerddom everywhere, from London to Tulsa, Beijing to Tel Aviv, and earlier this month, Los Angeles. In the crowded backroom of a sports bar on Wilshire Boulevard, correspondent Jennifer Sharp witnessed the spectacle and caught up with its host.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here to welcome you to Literary Deathmatch Los Angeles, Episode 9! Yes! Unbelievable!
My name is Todd Zuniga, and I'm the creator of Literary Deathmatch. Literary Deathmatch is a live event in which we feature four writers reading their own work for 7 minutes or less. They're judged by three all-star judges in the categories of literary merit, performance, and intangibles, and then they pick a winner from each round, and those two finalists compete in the Literary Deathmatch finale.
Come over here, young lady. I'm gonna wrap this scarf around your head. What I need from you guys is to cheer wildly while this lovely young lady tries to pin a mustache on Hemingway. If you could come forward, are you ready? Pin a mustache on Hemingway, cheer everybody for fun. Here she goes.
My name's Carolyn Kellogg, and I am a staff writer at the LA Times, where I write about books and publishing. So I go to a lot of literary events in Los Angeles, but Todd's Literary Deathmatch is totally different than all of them because it's so vibrant. He tries very hard to make sure the audience is participating by throwing things at them and encouraging applause rounds and stuff. Like, he really wants people to be actively listening.
My name is Ramona Isabel, and I'm one of the readers tonight. I felt nervous. It's, you know, it's a whole different venue than normal bookstore readings that I'm used to. I do all my work in my pajamas alone at my desk, so this is different. You have to put clothes on and be nice to people.
One of the coolest things that Literary Deathmatch does is it makes the writer the star. And in a world where everybody's like, me, 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 and we're dealing with reality TV in such a way that anybody can become a star, we're trying to make stars of these people that have actually created something really wonderful.
Other cars were on the road being driven home from one-night stands or filled with high schoolers avoiding their curfews. Those human-piloted automobiles caught the scent of the beautiful crash, and through their bug-smacked grills, their little oily hearts jumped. Thank you.
There's a lot of argument that the publishing industry is in a disaster state or it's all fallen apart. But I think the problem is that the bigger publishers don't have a very adventurous understanding of how to actually market writers to actual readers. I think they have a pretty dinosaur vision of that.
Now I want to welcome the judges off the stage. Give it up for Carolyn Kellogg, Moby, and Rory Scovel.
In terms of our judges, we try to get people that you wouldn't necessarily expect at a literary event. So Moby is a perfect example of somebody we want to judge because he's a musician, he's a DJ. Like, what does he know about literature?
Well, I like that you talked about J.D. Salinger dying. That was funny. And did you know, apparently J.D. Salinger had a remarkably low IQ. I read things, and I believe almost everything I read, even if I don't quite remember what I've read. So those are my comments, thank you.
Moby with the performance.
I like talking and being around other people because I live alone and I work alone. And I think deep down we're all pretty gregarious. So it's just nice to be around people.
Sarah Tomlinson. I'm a celebrity ghostwriter, and I'm also a novelist and a screenwriter. Todd Zuniga introduces people to each other. He wants them to form community, and I think that's so rare in Los Angeles, and especially among writers who can be so isolationist and, frankly, a little bit weird.
What I want you to write about is that I've taken up the battle for all that is frail in the life of artists and tell the good readers on Yelp that, yes, Taylor Negron is old, but he will never get a facelift because most surgeons in the Los Angeles area only give you two choices. Siegfried or Roy?
The most interesting thing that's happened in the 6+ years that we've done Literary Deathmatch is that writers more than ever understand how to use social media and how to be a personality almost. And that's strange because writers really, really love being writers in terms of being in the background, or they're little more than a photo on a book cover. You know, and there have always been those writers that are beyond that, but not every writer wants to Tom Wolfe around in a white suit.
Carolyn, I loved it. Let's start there. It was fantastic. You did what you do.
It made me think of Jonathan Franzen meets James Baldwin. Because it had all of that sort of first world problems, middle class angst.
I think everybody wants to feel literary and be literary. But it's hard right now because there's a lot of stuff. Our event doesn't compete against sitting down and reading Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Our event competes against staying home and watching Mad Men on your TiVo. like it competes against your email account, you know? And so one of our goals is to put on such a great show and to feature so many great people that you never once reach for your iPhone.
Anything is possible. The life literature hangs in the balance. Ladies and gentlemen, Chandler Nimrod is a literary deathmatch champion. Oh my God.
That was the hottest show we've ever had. I was wearing a three-piece suit, so I thought it was me, but everybody else said it was warm. So then I realized everybody was fainting. But I thought they were fainting like in that religious, you are healed way. I thought literature was bringing them to this point of delusion, but in fact, it was just out in the room. What a night!
And that was Jennifer Sharp reporting there from Los Angeles. Oh, yes. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We'll be talking to the wonderful Jim Lee and Peter York right after this.
Join us at midday London time every weekday for The Briefing, Monocle 24's fast-paced, hour-long roundup of global breaking news stories, in-studio analysis, and a first look at the North American front pages. And for those waking up on the East Coast, it's the perfect way to get a Monocle take on the stories you need to know at the start of each day. The Briefing, live at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York and 6 a.m. in Chicago.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. Now, Jim Lee has been taking photographs for 50 years. He's best known for his iconic fashion images from the 1960s and 70s when he worked with the likes of Yves Saint Laurent and Gianni Versace, not to mention photographing bands including the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. He did ads in the 80s, wonderful ones, and has refound the camera and, luckily for us, wanted to talk about his new book, an anthology of his work, on which he collaborated with his old mate, a magus of the style pages and arbiter of taste, Peter York.
To be absolutely honest with you, I really wanted to be a film director, which is probably not the best way to go about it by being a photographer, but it seemed a way at the time. So my luck broke when I went to Australia as a £10 pom and ended up, you know, renting a room from a Dutch photographer who said, if you print my pictures at night, then we'll give you a room for nothing. And at that point, a room for nothing was, you know, the money that I did have was better spent on food. And it was on a room, so I got a room for nothing to print my pictures. And that's where my very early beginnings of photography started, although it was along the right route, if you know what I mean, in terms of getting to where I wanted to be, which was eventually making films. But it was the journey I got stuck in for many years and became a photographer slightly longer than I wanted to be.
And it obviously starts presumably with commissions for the big magazines. Did lots of work for Harper's as well.
Yeah, it started very slowly because the work I was doing wasn't really towing the line very much. It was kind of rather, I think probably one could say more rough and ready and artistic and sort of me just, you know, flinging myself at anything artistically to make it interesting. Therefore, I wasn't really focusing on a commercial career at that point. Rather just trying to find something creative which would work. So after a while, I eventually climbed into a sort of a commercial way of photographing, and then...
And then the book lands with a boom.
With a boom.
Like that, on the studio desk. Yeah. Peter, obviously the words in the book are yours. It's a strange thing to have to describe your friend's work. I mean, how did you two meet? Maybe we should...
We met in the first instance to a great mutual friend who I'd been at school with. And then the thing that sort of put us together properly, I think, was Harpers and Queen, which was the 1970s version of the thing that is now called Bazaar.
Yeah.
And Harpers and Queen was going through a fantastic period in which it was, you know, there are magazines which have the moment. The Face had the moment in the early 80s, etc. And Harpers and Queen absolutely had the moment because although it was a fashion magazine, it allowed people like me to write at great length in the late 70s about things that the readership was not interested in, which is wonderful. So I was indulged.
And so Jim advanced your vanity
You could advance your vanity. It was completely wonderful because it was a flagship. It was the flash flagship of the group. And it almost made money by default because luxury advertising was boom, boom, booming then. So I was allowed to get away with murder. But a magic name you have to put in between is, of course, Anna Wintour.
Right.
Because Anna Wintour started as practically a teenager on Harpers and Queen and commissioned some of Jim's most interesting work and then went to New York and he followed her. So those are the relevant links. So I've seen quite a lot of it in action, if you see what I mean. I've seen shoots being shot.
So it was fashion photography in the 1970s and then the 1980s. 70s seemed to be the kind of era, the classic era of these slightly Guy Bourdin-style images, exactly. Lots of very sexy, very romantic, softly lit, like stage sets as well, very presumably high production values for these shoots.
High production costs, well, I think high production technology in your case, because we imported all that
those
lighting.
Lights, yeah, well, I think, because I was always sort of verging towards wanting to be a filmmaker, I bought in sort of film lights to my photography much earlier than perhaps I should. I was sort of trying to get myself to go there rather than... So if I felt if I had everything around me, which actually said this was making films, then I was sort of halfway there. So rather than use the flash that other people used, I started bringing in my film lights and bringing in crews and getting bigger sets and doing more moving things, which actually... And bigger productions. And by the time I'd ended up in sort of 1978 doing the kind of shoots I was doing, it was sort of... the big advertising jobs where there were budgets were there to afford them. And then beyond that, I then moved, to my first commercial as a director in 1978, which was Levi's, which was a jumping into the new quagmire of life, which I'm sorry to say, I lived in rather long, far too long.
I get the feeling it was quite a lot of fun.
It was fun. It was well paid. It was great. I brought up 4 children on it, educated them, fed them and holidayed and had 2 houses and all the awful things you do with money. But, it was a journey.
And Peter, it seemed to be a great time to be, especially in those creative industries, in fashion. As you say, the brands had money and everything was kind of on the up. Paint a picture of what those shoots were like, maybe, and the lifestyle that surrounded them.
Well, they were extravagant and they were indulgent and they were exactly what you'd expect. I mean, people didn't quite have Winnebagos, but they had tremendous egos. And I think what people don't realise is that during the 70s, people were fantastically fastidious, fantastically demanding artistically. And it's only just beginning to be recognised just how important those people were. You know, that whole idea, the decade that taste forgot. The people who were tasteful were excessively tasteful, quite Balmerly tasteful. You know, that's the founding ground of the sort of senior fashionistas of today. And it was very, very demanding. And they were very demanding.
And it seems like a lot of this sexiness, a lot of the parties that must have happened after the shoots carried into the next day's shooting, or the idea for a lot of your work, Jim. Because there's a lot of sexiness, there's a lot of sort of party scenes and a lot of those things. But they're your ideas, were they commissions that came from the magazines?
I think really, I can't quite explain why they happened as they did. But I mean, it was a fun industry to be in. We were there at the right time. We were definitely capitalising on an opportunity where things were evolving, I think, both in photography and now on into commercials later. But certainly those shoots were... I mean, I think they set the trends of how parties were. I mean, in New York, for example, when I was shooting there, Studio 54 was being built as we were there in the 70s. And, life around it that evolved from it was all important. And Ozzie Clark clearly was there, designing clothes and, in those early days. And he became, he's become iconic completely, but I mean, those days he was the greatest sort of designer of his time in the 60s, in an earlier period. But I think the sexiness, I never was as head-on with sex that I wanted to make it explicit. I mean, there was a sort of dangerous line to go down, which was sort of, in my case, I wanted to keep it sort of on the right side, that razor edge, so it wasn't actually pornography, but it could be kind of...
And very think, soft, but they seem...
But it's sort of sexy and edgy. Also, perhaps most of all, the ambiguity of my pictures is what I like to kind of lay a trail of. So when you look at them, you think and you think again, and you're not quite sure what you're seeing, whether it's is sexy, whether it's naughty, whether it's dangerous, whether it's whatever it is. But, I mean, it's that thinking matter, which... So content is perhaps more important to me. And I mean, there's always been this slight idea in my work, I think, that I've always felt I wanted to kind of slightly empower women in my pictures. So not, tread on them and keep them down under thumb. Because in the 60s, don't forget, I mean, women didn't have the vote in Ireland. We forget this. But I was always quite keen to kind of raise the profile for women, give them a leg up, give them a strength somehow in my pictures, so that I could sort of say that there was a view and a vision that we could see from a women's perspective.
Jim, Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
2 days, 48 acts and around 30,000 people. To sum up, that was the Sonar São Paulo Festival. The technology and new music festival, which started in Barcelona in 1994, has been expanding its horizons for the past decade, having hosted the event in cities such as Berlin, Chicago and New York since 2002. This year, Sonar made its way to Tokyo, Cape Town and São Paulo, with the Brazilian arm being the biggest Sonar outside of Barcelona. And after a successful year, the festival directors are hoping to make it an annual event in Brazil's biggest booming city. Monocle reporter Sheena Rossiter was there.
In a country that's known for being home to samba and bossa nova, Brazil seems like an unlikely place to host an electronic music festival. But clearly times have changed. Hordes of Brazilians and other Latin Americans have flocked to Sonar São Paulo. And with the likes of Kraftwerk, Justice, Chromeo, Cut Chemist and Doom on the lineup, it's certain that the crowd here will be kept moving during the 28 hours of music here, says the festival's co-director, Enrique Palau.
We are here to present Sonar São Paulo. That is going to run for 2 days with a lot of activities, three music stages presenting a wide range of music styles related to technology. So there's going to be a very interesting crossover, sometimes going from the hip hop to the funk to the techno to the electro, always with this electronic link going through all these different music styles. It's music that moves forward how technology advances.
And different musical styles indeed. Several acts on the lineup are making their first appearance in Brazil.
What's up? I'm Dave from Chromeo.
And I'm P.
The Canadian electro-funk duo took a brief hiatus from recording their next album to be at Sonar, and they plan to keep their appearance at the festival nice and light.
Humor is really important in our music. You know, we're two funny dudes to begin with, and we couldn't just see ourselves, you know, going all the way super serious. There's always got to be a little twist to everything, you know, in our lyrics, in our references, you know. Not funny, just humorous. Yeah, they can expect a lot of flesh. We have our lady legs with us.
Flesh and funk.
But will Chromeo's humorous stage show be lost in translation?
Look at us.
I'm going to be bare chest on stage. If that's not enough humor, you know, if that doesn't cross the language barrier, I don't know what will.
Olá, sou crioulo.
On the other end of the spectrum, local artist Criolo is warming up to make his appearance in front of a hometown crowd. The Sao Paulo hip-hop artist, who comes from the city's typically poorer outskirts, has exploded in Brazilian popular culture as of recent. And his appearance here is a warm-up before he gets introduced to a new audience across the Atlantic at London's Back to Black concert.
I'm very happy with the invite, very happy.
I'm really excited to be invited, he says, and I'm excited to get to know more of the culture and to see what the Brazilian people over there are up to. And to help my music grow, he says.
Contribuir de alguma forma com a minha música.
But this year's festival adds more elements than just music. Sonar Pro is an area purely dedicated to talks and demonstrations by interactive media companies from around the world. It's also an opportunity for foreign technology-based companies to get a foot in Brazil, an emerging market with little competition, as Enrique Palau explains.
It gives the opportunity to people to discover what's behind of some of these shows. They will work with new technologies, in this case with standard LED or very small wireless driving LED in the case of Esky. So people are able to discover how these technicians or artists are developing new tools.
And with a group like Kraftwerk having headlined the festival with a 3D show, musicians who are known for their fusion of technology and music, interactive technology has taken a hold of Brazilians, as Russ Rive, technology director of interactive media company Super Uber, explains.
Well, it's a really exciting moment right now in our area. I mean, it's always been a lot of fun and excitement, but
it's gotten to the point now where there's so much interest, and when people go to events and when people go out and engage in these social manners, technology has become such a fundamental part of all that experience. And how to put a human face on them, how to turn them into something that becomes intuitive, fun, and warm to interact with. The technology needs to be done so well that it disappears. And you really see it in people's eyes. And it's a really a magical moment, but seeing how these installations and these technologies are bringing all these different people together to have these really cool experiences together is really satisfying.
Russ takes me over to Super Uber's installation at Sonar, Sao Paulo. The Brazil-based interactive media company was chosen by Brazilian high-fashion clothing line Ellis. And a group of people here are playing around with Super Uber's creative way to be a peeping Tom.
It's a very minimalist installation. It's almost as if you're looking at these colorful window blinds that are slightly blowing in the wind as if it was an open window. And you can kind of see behind it that there's something going on, there's people moving. And then for you to actually open the blinds and interact with it, you step up to the interactive area, but it already opens up the blinds where I am. And I can kind of push out the sides and go and discover all these hot naked models behind the blinds here.
Super Uber is a 10-year-old pioneer in interactive media in a still-blossoming country. Russ Shrive points out that there is a massive market to grow in Brazil and that there's certainly more to come in terms of interactive media out of this Latin American giant.
Brazilians have a very creative way of looking at the world around them, and I think it might come from the lack of resources that they might have had, and so the way they put things together, use objects in a way that hasn't been used before. The desire to just like really fun and playful experiences is inherent in the Brazilian way of life and having a good time. Brazil actually has a huge group of really, really talented technology people as well as artists, right? They're changing the world in many fronts. You know, I would like to say that the group that works with us, our engineers are artists and our artists are geeks.
After 30,000 people filled Sao Paulo's Parque Anhembi venue, it's clear that Brazilians are now moving to a different beat. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Well, we've managed to cover a lot of ground today. The Havana Biennale, a laugh with our mate Mike Babilia, violent book nights in LA, the masterful and charming Jim Lee, and the ever aired and grace Peter York, and Sonar Sao Paulo. So that's why it's time to say that's all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be asking what's hot or not on Broadway. We'll explore the relaunch of Freeze magazine and ask what hits and misses came out of the Cannes Film Festival. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and the show was mixed by the glorious Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week. The club life of Havana reveals itself courtesy of Osmani Garcia, who calls himself Il Voz. And this is Tu Mujeres with Yalitza Bacalao. Thanks for tuning in.